The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your biweekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal from the Institute for Justice's Center for Judicial Engagement. I'm your host today, Diana Simpson, joined by IJ Senior Attorney Robert McNamara, as well as our special guest, Marissa Malik, who is a partner at King & Spalding. Marissa is a former clerk to Justice Thomas and Judge Pryor of the 11th Circuit. She's also a former IJer. Before law school, she was a fellow with us, with our activism team doing things against eminent domain. At King & Spalding, she's a member of the firm's Appellate, Constitutional, and Administrative Law Practice. She is also a member of the 11th Circuit's Criminal Justice Act panel, through which she is often appointed to represent indigent defendants. We're very lucky to have her today with a wild lineup of cases. We will start off with the 5th Circuit and a Black Lives Matter lawsuit. Bob?
Okay. So we're going to start with Doe v. McKesson, which I think may actually be the single most bonkers set of judicial opinions I have ever encountered. So the facts are serious. I should start with the serious facts. There was a Black Lives Matter protest in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, organized by a number of people, organized in part by DeRay McKesson, who's one of the sort of prominent grassroots organizers of the Black Lives Matter movement. And during the protest, the protest moves to block the street. And as the protesters are blocking the street, one of the police officers who is trying to do crowd control is hit with an unidentified heavy object. We don't know who threw the object. We actually don't know what the object is, but the officer was hit in the face and was apparently very injured. And that's, of course, something that shouldn't happen. And everything that followed from that is insane. The officer, proceeding as a John Doe, sued not just DeRay McKesson for organizing the protest, but he sued Black Lives Matter. He sued Black Lives Matter, the unincorporated association. He also sued Black Lives Matter, the Twitter hashtag. And the case got up to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit makes relatively short work of the lawsuit against Black Lives Matter. The technical reason you can't sue a Twitter hashtag is that it's a non-juridical entity, which is an entity that cannot be sued in its own name. And the practical reason you can't sue a Twitter hashtag is that it's a Twitter hashtag. I almost wish the case had gotten further. I really want to know what their theory of remedy was. Like, does everyone who ever tweeted the hashtag owe them a nickel? But you can't sue a Twitter hashtag, just like you can't sue libertarianism or lies. You can't sue abstract ideas. You have to sue entities that have, you know, bank accounts and a place where you can affect service. So the sort of unincorporated social movement that is the Black Lives Matter movement cannot be sued just as any other unincorporated idea cannot be sued.
The caption says that it's Black Lives Matter Network Incorporated. Is that true?
Apparently not. The panel opinion treats it as an unincorporated association, as the sort of inchoate group that we all know of as Black Lives Matter. My best guess is that the plaintiff's lawyer sued Black Lives Matter, Inc. because it sounded more juridical, which, you know, A for effort, but the panel seems not to buy it. And so you can't sue an idea. You can't sue an unincorporated just sort of group of people. There's no such thing as Smith v. Bunch of Dudes. And so that claim goes away, and we're left with Louisiana state tort claims against McKesson himself. And the theory of the tort claim is that McKesson led this protest into the street, that was an unlawful act, and that therefore he is the but-for cause of the unidentified person smashing the officer's face with the unidentified object. And initially, the panel accepts this. They say, yep, as a matter of Louisiana law, if you break the law, you're responsible for the actions of the people sort of you induced to break the law along with you, and so McKesson can be held liable. A few months after the panel issues that opinion, they sort of issue a second opinion, making the same conclusion about Louisiana tort law, but adding some analysis about why it doesn't violate the First Amendment to hold a protest organizer liable in this way.
Why doesn't it violate the First Amendment to hold a protest organizer liable in this way, Bob?
Well, it's a difficult question. What the panel reasons is that there's no sort of freestanding First Amendment defense to generally applicable tort law, and so they needn't interpose a First Amendment defense to this Louisiana tort. And, you know, the McKesson's folks sort of take that, they file a cert petition, and then out of nowhere, the panel issues yet a third opinion where suddenly it's no longer unanimous. Instead of being a unanimous panel, Judge Willett on the Fifth Circuit, without any motion pending, seemingly just on his own steam, changes his vote and issues a dissenting opinion in what I can only describe as just an extraordinary act of judicial menschiness. Judge Willett didn't have to do this. There was no motion pending asking him to do this. As far as I can tell, he just thought about the case for a while, decided he was wrong, decided his job was to get it right, and changed his vote and issued a new opinion. So in the new panel opinion, it's 2-1, and we have a dissent from Judge Willett making basically two points. One, that the panel's probably wrong about Louisiana law. Louisiana tort law probably doesn't make you liable for the crimes of anyone you're associated with, because Louisiana, like every other state I'm aware of, doesn't hold people responsible in tort for the crimes of third parties. And honestly, I think that has to be right. Like, if your theory of tort liability is just that McKesson was the but-for cause of this guy showing up to the protest and then breaking the law, it seems like that would encompass almost any association. Like, if I invite someone over to my house, even if I invite them over to my house and serve them like non-USDA approved beef in violation of federal law, and my guest then goes out and punches a cop in the face, there's a certain sense in which I'm the but-for cause of that person being in my neighborhood and, you know, in close proximity to the cop's face, but there's a much more real sense in which that's just an independent crime committed by an independent person. So Willett says the panel's probably wrong about Louisiana law. It probably doesn't create this tort in the first place, and if Louisiana wants to do that, probably Louisiana courts should make up that tort instead of the federal courts making up that tort for them. But then he goes on to say that if you're going to have that kind of strict liability, there's a real First Amendment problem, because it essentially holds protest organizers strictly liable for the actions of anyone who comes to their protest. And if your protest doesn't have a permit, if your protest is unlawful in any way, you suddenly become strictly responsible for anything that anyone in that protest does, despite the fact that you have no real control over who comes to your protest, you have no real control over their actions. And that seems to create sort of a troubling chill, Judge Willett says, on your ability to organize these protests.
So if someone jaywalks, you're going to be held responsible for any illegal activity that flows from the rest of the protest.
That seems to be the theory of the majority's new Louisiana tort. And so that's the panel opinion, but we're not done, actually, with crazy procedural developments in this case, because an unnamed judge of the Fifth Circuit, after Judge Willett issued his opinion, called for a poll of the Fifth Circuit, called for the Fifth Circuit to take the case en banc, again, without a motion from the parties. The whole time all of this is happening, McKesson's cert petition is pending with the U.S. Supreme Court, as kind of the case in the lower courts continues to change, which I imagine has caused some heartburn for his Supreme Court counsel. But someone called for a poll of the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit denied review in a tied 8-8 vote. So eight judges wanted to rehear the case. Eight judges didn't want to rehear the case, but the strangest thing is that one of the eight judges who didn't want to hear the case was Judge Ho on the Fifth Circuit. And Judge Ho's take is he doesn't want to rehear the case because no one in the case has raised what's called the fireman's rule. And the fireman's rule, which is a rule of tort, again, I think in all 50 states, says that if someone's a professional rescuer, if they're a fireman or a police officer, they can't sue you in tort for the injuries that are caused while they're doing their rescuing duties. You know, it's a rule that makes a certain amount of sense. If a fireman shows up, we don't want you to sort of prevent the fireman from getting into your house because you're worried he's going to break his leg. He's a professional rescuer and, you know, his injuries should be paid for by the public. He's provided by the public and he assumes the risk as a public guardian. And Ho's point is, look, I don't know why McKesson didn't raise the professional rescuer doctrine in the district court, but if he does raise the professional rescuer doctrine in the district court, he's going to win this case in a walk. So, you know, all of us should stop wasting so much effort and we should just send this back for him to plead this defense I have discovered for him. Which, again, is not wrong, but is bonkers. It's just one of those cases that has been fascinating to watch and I'm sure fascinating to participate in, except to the extent you are either paying your lawyers by the hour or are the defendant possibly facing $1 million judgment.
What's happening at the Supreme Court? Are they going to amend their petition?
I have no idea. I don't know what you do when this happens. Like, you file your petition asking for review, and they, you know, their petition was timely filed. It's currently pending. I would think you have to file either a new petition seeking review of the most recent panel opinion, or you just file a supplemental brief letting the court know that something has changed. But I mean, whatever you do, it makes your case look insanely messy and complicated, and insanely messy and complicated is not, you know, the first sentence you want in the memo a Supreme Court clerk writes about your cert petition. So it's when Judge Willett first issued his dissent, I sort of thought like, oh, this is great. This is like a love letter to the Supreme Court explaining why these First Amendment issues are important. And then once we got to the split en banc stage, I almost can't imagine the Supreme Court wading into this, especially in light of Judge Ho's opinion, which again, like, frankly seems right. Like, DeRay McKesson has a slam dunk tort defense that once it's raised in the trial court, particularly now that Judge Ho has written a, you know, thoughtful opinion explaining why it's right and why it's a slam dunk. Once that's pled, any district court judge is going to dismiss this case.
So is there, I don't know the procedural posture of this case. Was it dismissed? And is there, did he waive like his argument to raise this fireman defense?
So he hasn't waived. He definitely still has an opportunity to raise it on remand. So he hasn't lost anything. And Judge Ho is right that he goes back, he files an answer, the answer raises this, or he files a new motion to dismiss or a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And he should win that. It was originally dismissed. It actually, and this is a super nerdy wrinkle, but suing Black Lives Matter actually created a really thorny jurisdictional problem, because to the extent you're allowed to sue Black Lives Matter, the court has diversity jurisdiction in this case. And Black Lives Matter is an organization that has members everywhere. And so the court had to wade through whether you were allowed to sue Black Lives Matter, because if they had gotten away with suing the Twitter hashtag, they would have deprived the court of jurisdiction. Which is probably deeper than I'm allowed to go on this podcast.
Fascinating.
All right. Well, I guess we'll just have to see what happens from the Supreme Court and if the Fifth Circuit issues any new opinions in this case.
They have time for a couple more. I mean,
all right. Well, we will move on to the Eighth Circuit, where we've got a qualified immunity case stemming from a day at the pool. Marissa, why don't you tell us about this case?
Yeah. So I, with my friend David Shapiro, filed a cert petition involving a crazy Eighth Circuit case, not as crazy as the Black Lives Matter case, but still pretty crazy. So imagine that you're at a community pool in a very small town in Nebraska, and people are playing, and you're there with your friend, and your friend tries to throw you into the pool. You don't think it's going to end with a police officer body slamming you to the ground, but you would be wrong in Nebraska. So in this case, that's exactly what happened. My client, Melanie Kelsey, was playing with the pool with her friend, Patrick Caslin. Patrick tried to throw her into the pool. She, you know, was just playing around. They end up leaving the pool, and they are confronted by police officers who say to them that a domestic assault was reported by someone at the pool. And they both say to the police officers, no, that's not true. We're just playing around. That doesn't stop the police officers from arresting Patrick Caslin, the friend. He gets brought into the car. At this point, my client Melanie is starting to freak out. She goes to the police car and asks Patrick, who's now in the back, you know, what she should do. The police tell her to back away. She backs away about 15 feet. At this point, she starts to go back to the pool area because she sees that her daughter is yelling at a woman at the pool. Now, the daughter has now assumed that this woman who she's yelling at the pool was a person who reported the quote-unquote domestic assault. So Melanie starts walking towards her daughter. At this point, new cops arrive at the scene, and the old cops tell the new cops, Melanie Kelsey, she tried to interfere with this arrest. So one of the officers, Ernst, starts walking towards Melanie, grabs her arm, and says, get back here. At that point, Melanie turns to the police officer, who lets go of her arm, and says, I'm trying to see what that bee is saying to my daughter. And she walks away from the police officer. Now, at this point, the police officer then runs behind Melanie, tackles her down, and breaks her collarbone with such force. And Melanie is 5 feet. She is 130 pounds. She's an incredibly slight woman. She's not running from the police. She's not threatening the police. At the very most, she's suspected of a misdemeanor, interfering with the arrest of her friend. But in no way is she posing a threat. So the district court, Melanie ends up suing everybody involved. And the district court, dismisses all the claims against everyone except for the officer who ended up breaking her collarbone, saying that there were triable facts as to whether or not the officer would have been on reasonable notice as to whether or not he could use excessive force against Melanie. And the Eighth Circuit decides differently. And there is, it eventually goes en banc, and the Eighth Circuit still says that there is no clearly established law that would put the officer on notice that going after someone who is not running or fleeing or, creating any sort of diversion, he would not be on notice that this was excessive force. And the reason the Eighth Circuit gives is that there's no case that's directly on point. So there are cases, that might have similar facts, but there's no case that is exactly this case where someone walks away from a police officer who says, get back here. And that's why we filed this cert petition, because first of all, we don't think that the cop should have body slammed our client to the ground. And we definitely think that that was excessive. But more importantly, or less importantly, because obviously our client is the most important, but less importantly, the circuits are really split on whether or not a case to prove that the law is clearly established an excessive force claim has to be squarely on point, or whether or not it's enough that the cases are analogous. And of course, there are famous cases in the Supreme Court that lays out sort of factors that say excessive force is probably inappropriate in this circumstance. And this case fits into that model to a T.
Now, and this is one of those cases that I think really highlights what is so infuriating to people about this doctrine of qualified immunity, this idea that you need to have clearly established law before you can hold the government liable. Because I like to confess my biases. Like, I have a lot of law enforcement in my family. I'm generally sympathetic to the idea that police are frequently in these difficult hair trigger situations where they have to make hard judgments. But in practice, qualified immunity seems to treat government officials as like kind of moral monsters who cannot engage in any reasoning and can only take their instruction from the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And if the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has not specifically told you not to body slam a 5-foot-nothing woman, you can't be expected to know not to do that when, like, in reality, that the people who are supposed to teach you not to body slam a 5-foot-nothing woman are your mom and dad. They're not the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And I feel like we should probably be able to treat government officials like human beings who are able to make these decisions.
Well, that's what really bothers me about the whole doctrine, too, is it's based on this fundamental misassumption that police officers are reading circuit decisions, and that the training that police officers get somehow track these decisions. I doubt very much that in Nebraska, this police officer was trained and said, okay, well, if they're running really fast, you can body slam them. But if they're not, and they, walk away when you say, you have to use the magic words like, get back here, and then it's cool. I very much doubt that this type of training is occurring. And so the idea that we have a doctrine that's so unmoored from what it was at common law, that is an entirely judicially created doctrine based on an assumption that just doesn't prove out into practice, which is that these people, the police officer, actually reading these cases, and that's how they're guiding their actions, is pretty silly.
No, and that really, it's one of the, I've never heard it framed exactly this way, but it is kind of telling that the doctrine of qualified immunity is one created by federal judges, and its central premise is that everyone closely tracks the written output of federal judges. Which you can understand why the judges think that, but perhaps, Your Honor, they're not reading as closely as you might hope.
I think that's right. And, to the whole endeavor, too, and the circuit split really reaches this, is this idea that the cases need to be exactly factually on point. And that's the problem with this, is that every police incident is going to have a million different facts. And at some point, and I think that point has already come, this doctrine really becomes a shield for officers. Because any court could basically say, well, there's one other fact. This person was 145 pounds and not 130 pounds. So maybe she was more threatening. Or, this person, what happened if, the police officer in this case hadn't, released her arm? Would he have more justification there? It becomes really random. And if the whole idea behind this doctrine is police need to have notice, they're not really paying attention to these small minutiae.
And what plausibly could the officer invoke for why he felt the need to body slam someone that small? Like, it wasn't like she had a weapon. What could he possibly invoke as a reason for getting this forceful?
Right. And that's right. I mean, it'd be one thing maybe if she, you know, pulls away from his arm, doesn't explain to him what she's doing, and it looks like maybe she's fleeing arrest. But that's just not the case. She turns to him, he drops her arm, and she says exactly what she's going to do, that there is some bee who's talking to her daughter. And you can imagine the scene at the pool. Obviously, you can see a mother who's heated, and she's upset that this woman is talking to her daughter. And there is no evidence in the record, by the way, that the woman that the daughter was yelling at felt threatened in any way. So, you know, maybe his justification was, well, she was, you know, beelining towards this woman. I thought they were going to get into a fight. But there's just no evidence to support that. And importantly, and this is why we think that this case is really an ideal vehicle for the court, is the facts really are uncontested.
Well, wonderful. Okay, so that is...
Not wonderful. That can't be our transitive word.
I meant wonderful that there are attorneys taking these cases to the Supreme Court, and hopefully one of these days, hopefully with this case, they will take it and reevaluate the qualified immunity doctrine completely.
Yeah, you know, and even if they don't look at it completely and do it over, one of the issues here is that there is a two-step process in qualified immunity. The first step is saying, you know, was there a constitutional violation? And then the second step was, is that clearly established? And a lot of courts are basically skipping that first step. And the Supreme Court has allowed them to do that, frankly, and just says, well, it wasn't clearly established. And the problem here then is that you never know what is a violation of a constitutional right. So if anything, what the Supreme Court should consider doing, if not getting rid of the whole enterprise altogether, is at least making the judges say at step one, you know, what is a constitutional violation so that people in the future will be on notice.
And our last case today is a bench slap from the Seventh Circuit. Bob?
Okay, so we're going to end up with Baez Sanchez v. Barr, which is a case about the unwritten first rule of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, which is never make Frank Easterbrook angry. The case involves Jorge Baez Sanchez, who is a citizen of Mexico, present in the United States, and he's a removable alien because he was convicted of aggravated battery of a police officer. But he's also potentially eligible for what's called a U visa, which is a special visa for crime victims. And he asks an immigration judge to grant him a waiver of his removability so that he can apply for this visa. And the immigration judge says, yes, you've shown all the circumstances you need. I'm going to waive your removability. And the government appeals to the Bureau of Immigration Appeals, the Board of Immigration Appeals, sorry. And the board doesn't address whether he actually meets the criteria for the waiver. It just says, well, by statute, the power to grant these waivers is vested in the attorney general, not in immigration judges. And so the immigration judge wasn't allowed to give him the waiver. He appeals to the Seventh Circuit, and an earlier panel of the Seventh Circuit says, no, no, the power is vested in the attorney general, but by regulation, the attorney general has granted that power to immigration judges. He's delegated the power to the immigration judges. They have it. That's the only thing the board decided, so we're going to remand to see if maybe there's some other statute we didn't think of, or maybe he doesn't actually meet the criteria for the waiver, but immigration judges definitely have this power by reg. And they remand to the board. And rather than address any of the issues the Seventh Circuit enumerated, the board looks to a letter issued by the Department of Justice after the Seventh Circuit's opinion, which in a footnote suggests that the board's first opinion was right. And the board seizes on this to say, no, no, our first opinion was right. And so we're going to do the same thing and say this power is vested in the attorney general and not in the immigration judge. This, for practitioners who are listening, is what's known in the trade as a bad idea, because the case goes back to the Seventh Circuit, and Judge Easterbrook is displeased with the notion that the board seems to think it can pick and choose between the binding decision of an appellate court in this very case and a footnote in a letter written by the Department of Justice. Those do not have the same legal weight and legal authority. I hesitate to keep talking about this case because paraphrasing Frank Easterbrook is for suckers, and I should instead just read the entire opinion out loud. But he notes that it is a lucky break of happenstance that the alien, Mr. Baez Sanchez, didn't move for contempt, strongly suggesting that Judge Easterbrook would have found the board in contempt. And the Department of Justice has asked for remand in this case to let the board, you know, they don't really defend what the board did, but they ask just to remand so the board can actually consider the appeal in the first instance. And Judge Easterbrook says no. They have screwed this up so badly that there's no reason to give them yet another opportunity to demonstrate their disdain for his court. And so the appeal is over. The initial decision of the immigration judge stands. Mr. Baez Sanchez gets his waiver. And I imagine a number of people who work at the Department of Justice buy themselves new pants.
What would contempt look like if the board had been held in contempt?
I don't know, but I imagine it would be scary. At least theoretically, I mean, contempt can involve actual monetary penalties. And if Frank Easterbrook isn't high dudgeon, I imagine Judge Easterbrook would not hesitate to punish the people who believe they can just flout binding decisions of the Seventh Circuit. And this is, it's a nice illustration, actually, of kind of differing views of judicial power and judicial deference. You encounter some judges who think judicial deference is about, you know, the importance of the judiciary deferring to the elected branches as if the elected branches are somehow morally superior. And Judge Easterbrook is, you know, by reputation and by temperament, one of the most deferential judges on the bench. I think, you know, many people point to him as a paradigm of judicial restraint. But judicial restraint is different from judicial deference in the broadest sense. And Judge Easterbrook's position is there's a statute that gives his court authority over this when you file an appeal. And if a statute gives his court the power, his court absolutely has the power. And woe be to he who tries to defy that power.
So one of the things that I think most litigants and practitioners will be able to say is that litigation takes a long time. And I think this case is a really good example of that. I mean, this is, by my count, this decision from the Seventh Circuit is the seventh set of judges' decision stemming from a set of judges on this case and on this relatively acute issue about whether or not this particular gentleman can be eligible for this visa. And that's bonkers. I mean, you talk about bonkers opinions. This is the seventh decision, and he's finally getting what he's asked for.
And especially when kind of it seems like these are hard waivers to get, and there are a lot of criteria you have to meet. And none of these appeals are about whether he actually meets the criteria. Like, for all I know, the initial immigration judge's decision was wrong, and he doesn't meet the stringent criteria to get this waiver. It's all just been this squabbling over what the statute and what the regulations mean, and squabbling over them when, in this case, there's an authoritative appellate decision that tells you exactly what they mean. And even that sometimes is not enough to bring your case to a close.
What kind of power would the immigration judges have if they couldn't decide this? I mean, was this really a question that was being asked before, or was this entirely novel? It seems immigration judges are constantly considering these issues.
I mean, it seems, and this is reading a little between the lines of the earlier Seventh Circuit opinion, but it seems like the board's initial decision was just extremely off. Like, from the panel's earlier decision, they just missed a regulation. Like, there's a statute that vests this power in the attorney general, and then there's a regulation that delegates this power to the immigration judges. And the board didn't really say, like, that regulation is, you know, wrong or is misapplied here. From my read, the board just sort of read the statute as controlling. And the Seventh Circuit said, no, the regulation is controlling because, you know, regulations are more specific and they're usually controlling. And then it went back and they seem to have said, no, we really think the statute is controlling.
So was the statute ambiguous at all? Did it say like attorney general and designee? Because I could see there being an argument like under Chevron, right, that there was no power to issue this regulation if the statute was clear.
Yeah, so I think you could make that argument. That's probably the best defense of what they did the first time. And Judge Easterbrook's actually very clear that if they want to keep saying that, they're perfectly empowered to keep saying that. Like, the executive can just say, we disagree and keep going to court and keep losing, and that's perfectly okay. What they can't do is what they did here, which is in the very same case, say, no, we disagree and we're going to do it again.
All right. Well, that is it for today. Thank you for listening. And until next time, this is Diana Simpson from the Institute for Justice, coaxing you to get engaged.